It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, there's been a lot of talk about the best ways to empower girls, and helping them cultivate their sense of humor could be one of the best ways to do that. We'll learn why in a bit.
First, after a long, long night, Congress has officially passed a spending bill, one that includes hundreds of billions of dollars in federal spending on the military, domestic programs, and disaster relief. But getting to that point was anything but easy. Thanks to a one-man protest from Republican Senator Rand Paul, Congress actually missed a midnight deadline to vote on funding, resulting in a brief government shutdown. Here's some of what the senator had to say.
The reason I'm here tonight is to put people on the spot. I want people to feel uncomfortable. I want them to have to answer people at home who said, how come you were against President Obama's deficits, and then how come you're for Republican deficits? Isn't that the very definition of intellectual dishonesty? If you were against President Obama's deficits and now you're for the Republican deficits, isn't that the very definition of hypocrisy?
It didn't take long after that for Congress to vote on the deal, and President Trump signed it into law this morning. But what exactly are we getting with this new budget deal, and what does it mean for the country's budget and the budgetary process as a whole?
Alex Rogers covers Congress as a staff correspondent for National Journal. Alex, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, give us the basics. What was in this funding deal that finally got passed bright and early this morning, or not even bright yet, just early this morning?
Sure. Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky, who you just heard, did make lawmakers uncomfortable. The Senate passed the deal at about 1:30 in the morning. The House then passed it at about 5:30 in the morning, making a lot of those septuagenarians have to stay up very early to pass this two-year budget deal, which does a number of things. It suspends the debt ceiling to March 2019. It keeps the government open through March 23rd of this year, giving Congress more time to strike a longer-term spending bill. And it busts the caps, about $300 billion over the next 2 years. So it's a major deal that Congress did in the wee hours of Friday morning.
And I had thought initially that this was going to solve the budget, no more debt ceiling, no more shutdown for quite a while. But no, not quite. You said there's this March 23rd deadline now. What has to happen between now and then?
That's right. So there's been five short-term spending bills since September. The government has just been lurching from, you know, crisis to crisis, and this two-year deal does provide some sort of certainty going forward. It allows the appropriators to write a bill that will at least last us through this fall. But that is right. There's now another short-term bill that goes to March 23rd. It's unlikely that we're going to be back in the same place where we could see another shutdown as we did briefly today and also 3 weeks ago. The bill does a number of things that allows both Democrats and Republicans to kind of get on board through spendings for various priorities, such as $90 billion in disaster relief for Texas and Florida and Puerto Rico, states that were devastated by hurricanes. So it really picks in a lot of different constituencies and jams them all together, and we're unlikely to see another shutdown showdown later this year.
This was bipartisan in the sense that people from both parties voted for it and people from both parties voted against it. Can you talk about the breakdown a little bit?
Sure. So the House passed it 240 to 186. The Senate passed it 71 to 28. There were Democrats who opposed this bill because it did not address the DACA population, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program that shields deportation from hundreds of thousands of young adults who came with their parents as children illegally. And then there are also Republicans who didn't support this bill because it adds so much more to the debt. The country has $20 trillion in debt, and this bill escapes budget caps, as I was saying, by $300 billion. And as you heard from Rand Paul on the floor, it's probably not something that Republicans would have supported while President Obama was in office.
Talking to Alex Rogers from the National Journal about this budget deal reached late last night, passed through the course of the morning. Let's talk a little more about that deficit you were talking about, Alex. We just had the big tax overhaul bill that has a pretty big potential impact on the national deficit and the overall debt. And now this, is anybody but Rand Paul talking about the deficit right now?
Not many. In fact, there are a number of Republicans who were mad about Rand Paul taking to the floor, causing this brief government shutdown this morning. Senator Ron Johnson, Republican of Wisconsin, talked about Rand Paul's stance this morning, saying it's just further example of the dysfunction of this place. It's ridiculous, isn't it? So you're seeing a number of Republicans, even fiscal conservatives, who are frustrated by Senator Paul's stand this morning. There's a number of different things in this two-year deal that Republicans are happy about. It adds an additional $6 billion in funding to fight the opioid crisis, $20 billion to rebuild America's infrastructure, and an additional $165 billion increase in military spending. So Rand Paul is in a small minority here in the Senate, that's for sure.
I want to follow a couple different what's next paths. First of all, immigration. You mentioned some Democrats, especially in the House, voted against this because it didn't deal with DACA, the so-called Dreamers. Where are we? What are the plans to tackle that in both chambers?
That's a great question. So in the Senate next week, we're supposed to have a debate on this issue. And it's, you know, could be the most extensive one we've seen in 5 years. This is a question that has actually been knocking around Congress since 2001, when Congress first introduced the DREAM Act. And now, 17 years later, we're still talking about the fate of the so-called Dreamers that are protected by from deportation by an Obama-era program, the DACA program. And Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, has said that there's going to be a debate next week, open amendment process. We don't know what the bill is yet. And we'll see what happens. I think that the observers in town in D.C. are skeptical. They think that a temporary solution is the most likely one because the White House and Democrats in the Senate especially are very far apart.
And speaking of temporary solutions, it seems like that's most of what we have for the budget itself. You mentioned a frustration on the Hill with this, you know, one crisis to another sort of method of dealing with the budget. I understand there's now a new committee in the works to try to solve the budget system, solve the process. What's going on?
So, like immigration, Congress has again and again tried to tackle the budget, trying to find a fiscally responsible solution for the country. This bill, in addition to the tax bill, would add trillions of dollars in deficit spending over the next decade. And so Congress is trying to say, okay, we did sign a tax cut last year that added $1.5 trillion over the next decade. We did just pass a two-year budget that sets a much higher new standard. What can we do to actually tackle this issue? And so some senators who were very concerned about the deficit at least got a new commission that can be that they're going to debate over the next year or so up through the fall to try to find a pathway forward on this. But we've seen again and again Congress fail to actually do so.
We've seen past commissions, right, or at least committees trying to do roughly exactly the same thing before, right?
Right. So during the Obama administration, there was a threat, a blunt across the board spending cuts it was a mechanism to try and force a debate because Congress wasn't actually getting together on this issue. They failed, and those cuts actually went into effect. And because of both Democrats who were trying to protect domestic programs and Republicans who were trying to protect military programs, they've just escaped those budget caps that were put in place in 2011 and went into effect in 2013. So we've seen Congress try to actually address the deficit and try to reduce spending. But right now, even though we're not in a recession, we're seeing deficit spending unlike we've seen really since the beginning of the Obama administration.
And very briefly, Alex, they've allotted this money for military and domestic programs. Do they know exactly how they're going to spend it, or does that still have to be hashed out?
So the $300 billion in additional spending, we do know the breakdown. It's $165 billion increase in military spending. The rest is for domestic programs. There's also, as I was saying before, you know, $20 billion for rebuilding America's infrastructure, $6 billion in funding to fight the opioid crisis, money for community health centers, a couple billion for the National Institutes of Health.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Alex Rogers from the National Journal, bringing us up to date on the spending plan that passed in Congress early this morning. First, as more women enter fields previously dominated by men, there's been a lot of talk about the best ways to help girls feel more empowered and find their voices.
Our next guest says that helping girls find and cultivate their sense of humor can be a good first step in building that confidence. Ellen McCarthy is a staff writer for the Washington Post Style section. She recently wrote about girls and humor. Ellen, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So looking at this piece, this is just part of, the nuanced conversation about empowering girls. So why did you want to look at humor?
You know, my interest was sparked, in truth, after the election, when I noticed that some of the people who were coming out most powerfully in the resistance were women with backgrounds in comedy, meaning the Chelsea Handlers and Amy Schumers of the world. And it just sort of made me interested to think, you know, why is it that these women, you know, thinking of Samantha Bee even, are finding that they have a voice and a way to reach people that others weren't? And it sort of just sent me down a trail of sorts that made me really think about the ways that women and women's humor are treated and shaped in this world. And what I found was that there are some ways that women and girls are socialized out of using humor, and it's really subtle. Nobody ever says, oh, don't be a funny girl, or don't use your sense of humor, little girl. It's much more subtle than that. But even just getting the message, girls aren't funny, you know, that sort of thing seeps in. So these women who sort of bucked that and overcame it, it seems to me they got really used to using their voice. And so when there came a time when it was important to use their voice, it made sense to me that they were the ones who stepped up.
Now, and you spoke with a lot of women for this piece, and they ranged from ages, 13 to 37. For women who were already in the workforce, who are a little bit older, what were their experiences?
Yeah, so a lot of them sort of were able to think back and say, you know, gosh, I was a really funny little kid, but then I remember getting these messages, oh, sit still, be more quiet, tamp it down a little bit, hush, hush, or, you know, that's really not what ladies do, or, you know, act like a lady, meaning don't laugh so loudly, don't be so loud, don't be bawdy, don't be crass, words that are often very very gendered, right? When you think about even the words that are used to talk about women and humor, it's words like brass, you know, mm-hmm. Words that you don't hear applied to for men. So what these women often told me was that they were funny as little kids, but then something happened, you know, those subtle messages got through, and they often hid it into a private space with only their female friends, or hid it all together so that it was just sort of their internal monologue that became their sense of humor, and they didn't let it out into the world. And so for some of them, once they got through high school and sort of said, well, I don't care what anybody is telling me, I'm funny and I'm going to use it, they were able to reclaim that voice. But for others, who I spoke to both for the piece and then who I received a lot of reactions after that, felt that it never really fully came back. And that, to me, is the really sad part, that if you're not using that sense of humor when you're in junior high and when you're in high school, then you're missing out on all of this time practicing, right? Because using humor is a skill like any other skill, and if that muscle doesn't get used, it really can weaken and wither, and then it becomes much harder to flex it once you get into the workplace. And what we found is that it's a huge asset to have in the workplace. There are studies that show that when somebody is perceived as being funny, they're also perceived as being more confident, more competent, and they're more likely to be elected into positions of leadership. And gosh, those are things we want for our girls.
Sure. I mean, and it is really interesting to hear that humor is not necessarily something that comes naturally to people. Even the funniest people have to get that reinforcement that they are funny, and then they have the confidence to move forward. And even finding humor in what might seem like banal situations, being able to make something funny takes, you know, a fair amount of skill. Yeah. So I guess one of the questions that I have for you then is, at what point have researchers been looking at this specifically with girls so far as you can tell?
Very little. Really very little. I mean, there aren't that many serious psychological studies of humor in general. You can find a few, and there was one interesting one where a neurologist actually went to, like, food courts and college campuses and just sat and watched people interacting and took notes on who was making who laugh and things like that. So he had sort of really good data, but there's very little research done on humor in general and almost none done on humor and gender. So it's something I'd love to see more of.
We're talking to Ellen McCarthy right now. She is a staff writer for The Washington Post, and we're talking about how if you want your girls, your daughters, your female students to be empowered, that looking to humor and cultivating humor might be a good way to achieve that. And so you were just talking a second ago about studies done to look at, even though they aren't necessarily extensive, studies to look at, you know, who is cracking jokes. How does gender play a role between, you know, young men and young women in adolescence when they are, you know, still trying to figure out the world around them?
Right, yeah. And this is where psychology kind of leaves off and some evolutionary biologists step in with their theories of what happens. And what they would say is humor telegraphs intelligence, right? It takes a certain level of intelligence to be able to come up with a joke, come up with a crack right on the spot and respond. You know, nobody walks around with their SAT, hopefully, nobody walks around with their SAT scores in their back pocket. You don't necessarily, you know, go on a first date and say, you know, my IQ score is blah, blah, blah. But you can be funny, and that's a way of showing intelligence. And what these evolutionary biologists would say is that women are inherently looking for providers, and it's no longer big, beefy, brawny hunters who will provide best for a family. It is people, it's, you know, men of intelligence that would have the biggest earning capacity. And so it becomes this very sort of basic biological explanation for why men are more likely to crack jokes in crowded bars and in the context of women, and why women might laugh more. There's a, you know, this old saying that, you know, when a guy says that he's looking for a woman with a sense of humor, what he really means is that he wants somebody to laugh at his jokes. And
sure.
It's sort of horrifying, but I think, you know, a lot of us see that in practice, you know, that there's not, when they looked, there was one study that looked at online dating profiles, and it was really important to women to find a guy with a sense of humor. It was really not that important to most guys to find a woman with a sense of humor. And what the evolutionary biologists would say is that it's not necessarily the sense of humor that people are interested in. It's that next level intelligence that can honestly bring a higher income.
Sure. And so looking back at girls, I mean, I want to use that word sort of generally, but, you know, mm-hmm. kids that are female or, you know, identify as female who are trying to still figure out the world. And you spoke with some young girls about trying to be funny, wanting to be funny. You know, what did they tell you?
They told me that they were funny, well, right? They see themselves as funny, but they were cognizant of the fact that their humor gets shut down more, both from adults and from boys. Now, I'm talking specifically with girls who've sort of entered middle school, junior high age, and high school. They can really recount times where, you know, a boy would have said to them, "That's not funny. Leave it to us." And, you know, another girl remembered a time when she made a joke and everybody kind of sniggered, but then, you know, the boy next to her made a very similar joke and everybody laughed and laughed, you know. And so the girls I talked to were conscious of this and were conscious of the fact that it didn't seem to be winning them a lot of points, either with their teachers or with their male peers. Now, I think that once you get into older high school and into college, all of that sort of shifts and confidence level shifts. But, you know, you got to think about, gosh, you know, in my day it was 17 Magazine, but today I know it's all on YouTube. And what it, what is, what's the focus for girls? You know, what does society tell girls they need to focus on? Well, you know, the contours of their makeup, mm-hmm. right? Their perfect homecoming outfits, how they look, how they look, how they look. You know, there's not a lot of Teen Beat magazine saying, here's why it's important to be funny, or here's why you should use your voice and speak up, even when you're saying something that isn't necessarily popular. It's important to claim your voice. It just isn't the focus, unfortunately, for teenage girls, and I think that they can lose their voice a little bit because of it.
Girls who want to cultivate this have the desire to be funny, want to be funny. We would imagine that their parents would also want them to feel confident. So how can parents help girls find their senses of humor?
Yeah, I think it starts really young, and it starts with modeling, right? If you're funny with your children, boys and girls, of course we want boys to be funny too. I mean, my feeling is, gosh, don't we all just want, especially today, as many people to be funny as possible, just so that we have this great, you know, light, wonderful way of being in the world through humor. So modeling it, being funny with your kids, cracking jokes, telling jokes to each other, being silly, not being afraid to, you know, dance around and be a goofball so that they then feel comfortable doing that. But I think the other thing is encouraging their attempts at humor, even failed attempts, right? Because like we were saying, this is a skill that's practiced. And so when you are out there shooting basketballs, you don't hit everyone, but the more you shoot, the better you get. And so praising even attempts at humor that maybe you don't find funny as a parent, but that kid is asking you, is that funny, Mom? Is that funny, Dad? Yeah, just going along with it and laughing. I think those are really important ones. But then also, you know, sharing humor with them, you know, seeking out, if your kids are on YouTube, let's watch some videos of Ellen DeGeneres or whoever you, and there are tons of YouTube comedians now, and, you know, steering towards those rather than the, you know, Kim Kardashian-style makeup tutorials.
Well, Ellen, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Ellen McCarthy is a staff writer for The Washington Post. She joined us to talk about why cultivating humor in girls can help them be more confident.
Food Friday is up next here on Central Time. Now, it's sometimes difficult to resist the siren song of a restaurant, especially if you're feeling too tired to cook. But fear not, our next guest is here to make a case that dining in can be just as fulfilling and perhaps more rewarding than dining out.
And we've issued a little bit of a challenge to our guest today, making beans, lentils, and other sometimes ho-hum pulses a little more exciting for the at-home cook.
Allison Roman joins us now. She's the author of Dining In. Allison, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, before we get into particular recipes, make the case for dining in and cooking, therefore, more than we do.
Well, you know, I think that we have sort of fetishized what it means to eat at a restaurant, and it's this fun, entertaining experience, and we spend a lot of our money and a lot of our time at restaurants. But, you know, I think that if you cook at home for yourself or for your friends or whomever, I think that you'll find with the right recipes and the right guidance that it can be just as satisfying and entertaining and fun and obviously delicious as a restaurant.
Now, how can we make dining in a little bit more of a treat? We're talking about how, you know, it's hard to resist the siren song. So I guess how do you make it a little bit more exciting for people?
I think that you have to just approach it from, you know, a perspective of A, willing to try new things, and B, just, you know, even if it's a Tuesday, kind of treating it a little bit more special. And that doesn't mean you have to take more time or spend more money or, you know, go totally crazy and go to 18 different grocery stores. And, you know, it doesn't have to be elaborate to feel a little bit special. And, you know, I think that whether that's trying something new, whether it's an ingredient or a technique, just something above the average, you know, okay, I'm just going to make the same pasta or the same chicken that I always do.
And you don't consider yourself, you're right, that you're not a lazy cook. You use the term lo-fi.
Lo-fi.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah. You know, I mean, lazy has a negative connotation.
I'm okay with it.
Yeah. I mean, let's be honest. I'm a little bit of a lazy cook, but I use lo-fi as, you know, in terms of just feeling like I don't love a ton of equipment. I don't have a ton of fancy tools. I'm not trying to use the latest and greatest in, you know, appliances. I don't have a million different spices and every ingredient under the sun. You know, I'm pretty basic when it comes to what I like to cook with and how I like to cook it. And so I think that, you know, once you understand that and can accept that about yourself, which I have, it took me many years, but, you know, it doesn't have to mean that's boring. It doesn't have to mean that that is not exciting to you. You know, I think it's about how you treat those ingredients and what you do with them, but it's not about what you're working with necessarily.
So for maybe some of our audience that might consider themselves either in the lazy or maybe want to adopt the lo-fi cook category, you know, what advice would you have for some of these cooks who want to be a little bit more adventurous without, you know, maybe making that 18 grocery store run?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, if you read through a lot of the recipes, I think you'll find first, you know, oh, most of them are 8 to 12 ingredients, which means you're not going crazy with the amount of things that you're buying for this dinner, half of which I'm sure you already have on hand. And it's really about, you know, changing up one or two things in that recipe to make it a little bit special. So there's, you know, the dish that's on the cover is this seared chicken thighs. And you can use any cut of chicken you want. And, you know, that's the other thing is I want people to feel like they can adapt it to what their preferences are and what they have access to. But instead of just adding onions to the skillet at the end, you kind of pickle the onions first in lime juice and then you add them to the skillet. And it completely changes the dish and makes it something a lot more exciting with just one extra step that's, you know, covering onions and lime juice, which takes 2 seconds. So it's the little things.
We're talking to Allison Roman. Her cookbook is Dining In. And Allison, you cover a lot of ground. We wanted to narrow it down a little here. And we went for beans and lentils, I think in part because, you know, we're in the middle of winter here in Wisconsin. Lentils out of a bag or can or beans out of a bag or can taste the same in February as they do in August. They're kind of always in season. And one good example, I think, of lo-fi cooking, sometimes you'll hear from people like, oh, no, only use dried beans and you soak them overnight and blah, blah, blah. You're fine with canned beans if we're in a hurry. No problem.
Of course I am. Even sometimes when I'm not in a hurry, I think that the consistency of them in the same way that a canned tomato will give you a different product than a fresh tomato. And they're both great and they have their different times and places. But, you know, I love cooking beans on a Sunday when I have nothing going on and I'm home or I'm working and, you know, I'm feeling lazy and I have the luxury of time. It smells amazing. It's a great way to spend your afternoon. But more often than not, that is not where I'm at time-wise. So a can of beans is delicious. And, you know, most of them, you know, once you find a brand that you like and trust, which is to say that it doesn't have too much salt or, you know, they don't, you know, whatever that part is for you, the texture of the bean is important. You know, it tastes the same every time and it's going to be consistent and it's going to be delicious.
And do you think that consistency might, you know, fall into or might push it along that, you know, beans and lentils don't always have the greatest reputation. They're not always the most exciting of the dish, but I mean, they're delicious.
The word lentil, the word bean just inherently is the least exciting word I could possibly come up with. But that's the thing. You know, you take a can of beans, again, can of bean, not a great phrase, not super exciting, but you sizzle it in some garlicky olive oil with some chili flake and you finish it with, you know, anchovies or some lemon and fresh herbs. And it's awesome. And honestly, it tastes like you've been cooking them all day.
I've made lentils in my life that do not look good, I'll say. They are, you know, they are what people, I think, picture a hippie lentil dish to look like.
Totally. I lived in Santa Cruz for a time, and I know all about that. But, you know, I think that lentils are the kind of thing where each lentil is so different that you kind of have to experiment and say, okay, these are the lentils that take forever to cook. These are the lentils that cook in 5 minutes. This is a lentil that's better for soup and stews, and these are better for a grain salad. You know, there's so many different types, and they're really not all created equal.
And you gave us a few recipes, and I want to start with the lentil one. We have this at WPR.org/Food Friday, by the way. Spiced black lentil salad with oil-packed tuna, radishes, and purple potatoes. Just the visual, not even looking at the picture, you see this is going to look good. Tell us about this recipe.
Well, it's basically a version of a, you know, classic tuna niçoise salad, but it's served over these lentils that I kind of keep in my fridge as a base for most things. And I eat them plain and I eat them in a salad like this. But essentially what it is a black lentil, which, you know, beluga lentil, also known as, and they're really firm. And so they don't turn to mush when you cook them. So they're a lot more grain-like than, say, a lentil that you would find in like an Indian dal. Like they don't disintegrate. They don't turn to mush. They hold their shape really nicely. So you cook the lentils almost just like pasta. You boil them until they're tender, drain them. And then I make an oil with, you know, I sizzle some lemon peel and spring onions and seeds like fennel and cumin and coriander and garlic. And then I pour it over the lentils. So you have this kind of already dressed, delicious lentil dish, right? And like I said, I eat it happily out of the container from the refrigerator all the time. But it's also really beautiful as the base of a salad, as if you're making a grain salad. And my favorite way to do that is with some oil-packed tuna, which I think is superior to the water-packed variety. And then, you know, in the springtime, that's when this dish sort of came about, which you have a bunch of beautiful radishes of different colors and shapes and potatoes. And, you know, if you can find purple potatoes, great. Most Whole Foods carry them at this point. But regular old potatoes will work as well. And then you top it with a bunch of fresh herbs, maybe some green beans, lots of lemon. And it's this really satisfying, vibrant, delicious dish. And it's something that actually you can make in the wintertime because most of those things are around year-round.
What was interesting, I was looking at the book, going through it before the interview today, and, you know, this is, as you said, a Niçoise salad, which I think for some people might be a little intimidating if they've seen it in a restaurant or something, but the way it's put together is really simple. So do you think it's for some of these lo-fi cooks who might be interested in these recipes that they seem more daunting than they actually are?
Right, and that's the thing, and again, I want to give cooks that are reading the book the freedom to say, I don't have purple potatoes, I'm going to use regular potatoes, or I don't have green beans, I'm going to only use radishes, or I'm going to use some sliced fennel instead, or I'm going to add eggs to it, or I don't want eggs in this. You know, I want them to kind of make it their own, and that's what's really exciting about following a recipe almost. You know, you use it as inspiration and as guidance, but, you know, you should have the freedom to make it your own depending on your taste and what you have. And I think that's really empowering to the home cook. You know, instead of saying, this is how you have to do something, I'm more saying this is how you can do something.
Allison Roman is with us. She's the author of Dining In. She's with us on this Food Friday to inspire us to try some new things in our cooking at home. And we're focusing on beans and lentils and making them an exciting part of our at-home cooking.
And you can join in by calling 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about beans and lentils? What are some of your favorite dishes to cook at home? And have you found any tricks to make dining at home a little bit more exciting? You can call in now at 800-642-1234. Again, that number is 800-642-1234. Or you can send a tweet to @CentralTimeWPR.
We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time.
Now, Allison, one of the other recipes we wanted to take a look at was your crispy chickpeas and lamb with greens and garlicky yogurt. How did you put those ingredients together to come up with this dish?
Well, that's sort of my back pocket, regular, run-of-the-mill weeknight dinner. And I love, sometimes I make it without meat, but just the idea of cooking chickpeas that way has always really, I've really been into it. Because you take a chickpea out of the can and it's kind of slimy, it doesn't do much. You know, I think of the salad bar, you know, when it's just these raw chickpeas, they don't have much flavor. But if you toss them in oil, crisp them up in a skillet with some garlic, they are amazing, and they completely transform. And I challenge anybody who thinks they don't like chickpeas to try the chickpeas this way, with or without the lamb. And, you know, the lamb is just a way to kind of get some added protein and make it feel a little bit more substantial. And it's, you know, bowls are very popular right now. People love grain bowls and salad bowls, and this is sort of my version of that. And so you have your grains and your meat, the chickpeas and the meat that you cook almost at the same time, and some spices and garlic. And then you serve it over garlicky yogurt, and then I add some Swiss chard and tomatoes if you have them. No worries if you don't. And to me, it's just the most satisfying, delicious, hearty meal that you can have. And I sort of change it up as the seasons go. Sometimes it's kale, sometimes it's spinach, sometimes I use fresh greens if those are around. And I'm continuously satisfied by this, and it never gets old.
One thing that stood out to me, as I'm sure it probably will stand out to a lot of people, in the recipe, it does call for a fair amount of olive oil, about 6 tablespoons. Some people might be a little taken aback by that amount, but why should people use that much oil?
If you know, I tried to get around it, and I think I mentioned as much in the book, but you really can't get that crispiness from the chickpea. They really tend to absorb that oil. But, you know, 6 tablespoons for 4 people isn't that much. And it's significantly less than anything you would get in a restaurant, I assure you, having worked in one. I promise you this. And I know it can be a little scary to see that. But also, olive oil is not the worst for you. And, you know, while most of the dishes in the book are pretty conservative with the oil, unless otherwise noted, you know, I think that for something to cook properly, I'm going to tell you how much oil you need. And it would be nice to say you only need 3 tablespoons, but that's not going to cut it.
Marie in Madison emails, I adore using crispy chickpeas. I use them in a Buddha bowl I make often with kale, arugula, sweet potatoes, and lime juice. I use cumin, cinnamon, and paprika to season the chickpeas. That sounds like a pretty good combo.
That sounds delicious.
And I read about somebody who you just used to love eating chickpeas right out of the can growing up. That was you, right, Allison?
That was me, yeah, before my taste significantly refined. But yeah, I did. I guess I didn't quite mind the slimy texture when I was a small one, but now I only demand the crispiest chickpea.
Yeah, you were saying a little bit earlier that this is your back pocket meal. How quickly does this come together?
You know, I'd say depending on what else you're serving it with, you know, the whole thing probably takes about 20 minutes.
Oh, so pretty
yeah.
fast.
You know, I mean, I sort of have a tendency to cook things a little bit higher and hotter than I see most home cooks doing, just because I know what it takes to actually burn something. And you have to cook something for very, you know, you have to really, really want it to burn. But, you know, you stand over the skillet, you shake it occasionally, you make sure everything's getting kind of evenly browned and cooked. And cooking at medium high heat for this dish, especially, yeah, I think you're looking at around 20 minutes.
That recipe for crispy chickpeas and lamb with greens and garlicky yogurt, you can get through the Ideas Network Facebook page or at WPR.org/Food Friday. Just staying with chickpeas for a moment, another recipe in your book, I wouldn't have thought of this, baked eggs with crushed chickpeas and then chorizo and breadcrumbs, but the crushed chickpeas mixed in with eggs.
Yeah, so this is sort of the idea that, you know, chickpeas and grains and other legumes like that are actually amazing during the morning. And many countries serve you, you know, a version of like a lentil porridge or soup almost with those things. And I love the idea of baking eggs into it. And this is something that you don't have to use as breakfast. Oftentimes, you know, I've made this dish for dinner before, but the idea being that these crispy chickpeas that you kind of crush with the back of your spoon as you, you know, coat them in the chorizo, and they kind of just serve as like the loveliest little nest for your baked eggs. And unlike a shakshuka, which the eggs can sink into the tomato sauce and sometimes the eggs can cook unevenly, the eggs here really just kind of sit perfectly on top of the chickpeas. So they cook a little bit more evenly. The yolks stay a little bit more runny. And, you know, you can top them with a mess of herbs or greens and serve it with something creamy like yogurt if you like. I love chickpeas and yogurt. I know not the only one, but they really are best friends. And, you know, it's super satisfying. It's one of those breakfasts that you could, you know, eat around 11 on a lazy Saturday and then not eat again for a few hours.
Yeah, that sounds really good. Now I'm sitting in here really, really hungry.
And look at the picture,
yeah,
too,
the picture is gorgeous. It does kind of look like a nice, like, really hefty shakshuka from where I'm sitting across the studio from Rob. But so we do have a little bit of a cheat recipe. It's not exactly beans, but it is green beans, blistered green beans with creamy tahini and fresh hot sauce. You know, tell us a little bit about that.
So I love green beans, but I hate an overcooked green bean. I want my beans in that context, like the fresh shelling bean, I'm thinking broad beans, Romano beans, your regular old green bean, haricot vert. I want them to be cooked super hot and super fast, right? I want the outside to be just tender, and I want them to still have that little bit of bite and crisp to them. I love them raw too, but cooking them briefly in a super hot skillet or grilling them just kind of takes the edge off. It makes them taste a little less green, you know? They're obviously green beans, but it takes away that rawness. But it still keeps their beautiful texture. And I love to eat them every which way. But this, to me, is one of the best because you have this creamy tahini sauce that you dip them in and then chilies that you soak in a little vinegar and garlic and pour over, which sort of is like a hot sauce situation. And it's not quite as deep in flavor as it would be, you know, a Tabasco, something that's aged, but I like it because it's really just like this fiery vinegar sauce that is like this freshness that you can't get out of a bottle.
We're talking to Allison Roman. Her cookbook is Dining In. She's sharing some cooking inspiration, a little bit of focus on beans in our conversation here. We got an email from Deborah. Deborah emails, I spent the summer of 1989 in Maine, mostly living out of my 1980 Volkswagen Rabbit. One of my memorable meals was a can of B&M baked beans cooked over a small kerosene stove. They were awesome. Quite sure it wasn't just that I was hungry. They were above and beyond any baked beans in a can I had ever eaten. I think there must have been, it must have been something in the moment, too.
Oh, yeah.
Are you a fan of baked beans yourself, Allison?
You know, I am not. And only in that context, because there is a recipe in the book for what I think are the best baked beans. And I make a mention that there is no sugar, there's no ketchup, there's no molasses in my recipe. And maybe it's because I grew up in California. I don't know. Baked beans seem to be a very East Coast thing. Or maybe it's because I didn't grow up camping. I don't know. But I'm not the biggest fan of that. But I also tend to stay away from, you know, sweeter, savory foods in that way. So my baked beans have a lot of garlic and white wine and bacon and breadcrumbs and caramelized onions. Like, they're deeply, deeply savory.
We really quickly want to take a call from Ashley. Hi, Ashley.
Hello.
What was your question?
So I am making, Allison, your shortbread salted chocolate chunk cookies as we speak.
Wonderful.
And I was actually on your Instagram looking for some guidance and help because I'm trying not to panic right now as I make them. So I have a hand mixer and not a stand mixer. Uh-huh. And so when I was mixing the butter, I missed your helpful tip that if you have a hand mixer to make sure your butter's a little bit warmer. So I felt like I was mixing my butter for like 7 minutes or just a long time. And now I have all the flour and the chocolate in there. But it's really crumbly.
Yeah.
And I'm worried that I don't know, that I messed something up.
No. All right, Allison, talk Ashley down here.
No, Ashley, you're great. Your cookies are going to be great. I would just say kind of knead the dough a little bit with your hands. And not only will that soften the butter slightly with the warmth from your hands, but that's also going to make sure that your flour is all the way incorporated. And, you know, the thing with the hand mixer is that it really doesn't have the power of a stand mixer, which is why I recommend you do it for a little bit longer and use maybe slightly softer butter. But your dough is fine. The ratios, as long as all the ingredients are measured appropriately, there's nothing that you can't fix at this point. So as you are preparing to mold them into the logs, just kind of give them a little bit of a knead with your hands, and it should feel almost like Play-Doh. And if it feels dusty or floury, keep mixing. But if it just feels crumbly, that's okay, because it is a shortbread. It is a crumbly dough. I think if you'll see on my Instagram, there's a photo of the dough. It's pretty crumbly, and that's fine. So just force it into the log, kind of just like you're making a little thing out of Play-Doh. I don't know, like a house. I don't know what you make out of Play-Doh. It's been years. But, you know, you kind of can force the dough together at that stage as you're rolling it into the log, and then you should be good.
Glad we could help, Ashley. Allison, briefly, as we wrap up, what is on your menu this weekend, beans or otherwise?
Well, actually, tonight I'm going to a pizza party for the Olympics opening ceremony. So I'm not cooking, decidedly. And then the next day, I am getting ready for a dinner that I'm cooking on Sunday at a great restaurant here in New York called Cafe Altro Paradiso. And we'll be cooking some dishes from the book, which are great. We're doing this really great fish with preserved lemon relish, the steak with buttered radish toast, and a few other awesome surprises.
Sounds great. Allison, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Allison Roman. She's the author of Dining In. She joined us to talk about the joys of opting to dine in instead of out. And she talked about some of the best ways to make beans and lentils a little more exciting. We've got three of her recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. You inspired?
Oh, absolutely. I am actually really excited. I love lentils already, but this kind of ups the game a little bit more.
I've been doing a lot of lentil soups. I've tried like crispy chickpeas before. Mine didn't turn out that great, but now maybe with some of her recipes, I'll give it another go.
I think
go.
You just have to up the oil. That's probably the biggest takeaway.
All right. Check out those recipes again on the Ideas Network Facebook page or WPR.org/Food Friday. If you're having trouble expressing yourself in texts and online, good news for you, there's a new batch of emojis on the way.
The expressive symbols were approved by the Unicode Foundation, which is the industry group that decides which emojis get released into, I guess, the digital wild.
Now, all the companies that use these things, Google, Apple, Facebook, whatever, they're going to make up their own unique designs for each of these baseline emojis.
And highlights include more faces of people with red hair, a smiley face with a bunch of hearts, feet for some reason, and a whole lot more. There are about 157 in all.
This doesn't have a lot of impact on my life. I'm not a big emoji guy, if you can imagine. Use them, but I think ironically in kind of a hipster way.
You know me. just using emoji for the eye rolls. No, I do like emojis. I use them maybe more in our official Slacks than I should, but I'm on board with these new ones coming out.
Are you gonna take them for a spin once they're officially released?
Yeah, you might end up getting a lot of feet ones to see your reaction. I can tell right now that you're going to be super on board with it when you get them.
I will look for some of the angriest emojis possible to respond.
I mean, this will be how we get you into using emojis.
It's a good thing.
Through anger.
It's good we're on the radio. We're emojiing every day here on Central Time.